This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear how employees at a tech company in Wisconsin have agreed to be implanted with microchips. We'll be joined by privacy expert Liz McIntyre, co-author of the book Spy Chips, to discuss the implications of this new development. We'll hear how bringing the arts to survivors of human trafficking can literally change their lives. Crossing Point Arts founder Anne Pollock tells us the importance of this therapy. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Bogosian. For the past decade, Law and Disorder has reported how the RFID chip, or radio frequency identification chip, has intruded into our daily lives. They're embedded in nearly all consumer products for a variety of reasons, including inventory, shipping, and marketing. The small chips carry data that can be scanned and downloaded by reader devices. Among the many corporate patents and plans for RFID include implantable chips in human beings. A microchip antenna encapsulated in glass is injected into the flesh. Companies such as Verichip, which manufactured the implantable microchip, weren't that successful. But 16 years and several name changes later, companies such as Applied Digital Solutions are trying it again. Recently, 50 employees with a tech company in Wisconsin agreed to have microchips embedded into their flesh. To talk about security implications in this, we welcome back consumer privacy expert Liz McIntyre. She's co-author of the book, Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and the Government Plan to Track Your Every Purchase and Watch Your Every Move. Liz McIntyre, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, hello, Heidi. It's so good to be back with you. It's been a long time.
It has. And I must say that whenever I see the book Spy Chips flash across my screen for whatever reason, I think it's time to have you back on. And now it is, given what we've been hearing about a tech company in Wisconsin microchipping their employees. And we wanted to start by talking about that. You predicted this kind of thing could happen years ago, and now it is. What did you think when you heard this news?
Well, actually, it's really, really interesting. And maybe first, before we talk about that, for your listeners, we might want to just explain what this microchip is that's being implanted in people, and so they understand the technology and why it is such a big concern. Of course, the microchip we're talking about is a glass-encapsulated communication device. It's passive with no battery, and it contains a unique identification number that's kind of like a social security number for things. So it can link to unlimited information, and this microchip is inserted into human flesh, and it can communicate silently and invisibly from a distance, a short distance in this particular case, but could be very problematic for privacy nonetheless. So the chip, you know, anytime it's within range of a reader device, which is what is needed to power it up, which frankly could be embedded in our modern cell phones, it could be basically hidden anywhere because it communicates by radio frequency. So just like your radio can, you know, your radio waves can travel through walls and windows and doors, you know, the technology that, you know, communicates with these microchips can do the same thing. So you can have reader devices hidden just about anywhere. So if you have one of these microchips embedded in you and you get close enough to a reader device, you could communicate this unique number and it could identify exactly who you are, exactly where you are, and a lot of other things about you. So that's kind of some background. And I think knowing this and associating that with a unique number like a social security number in this potential database, I think that kind of gives your listeners a sense of you know, the danger involved. I mean, most people just immediately make that connection. It's like, wow, you know, Would I ever wear my Social Security number in a T-shirt? No, that would be crazy. Same thing.
Well, let's sort of depict a scenario here. If I work for XYZ Corporation and I consent to having this small chip embedded under my skin with certain personal data on it, I had sort of envisioned they need to hold a wand or a scanner over you that you're aware of, but you're saying that it could be a tiny reader device could be embedded, say, in the entranceway to the business or in the boss's cell phone. And if he or she is near enough to you, they can read your chip.
Okay, sure. Okay. Well, you say that the boss could have a reader device in his cell phone or her cell phone. But in fact, that reader device could be in the employee's cell phone, and a lot of companies are giving employees cell phones and are already tracking them through those cell phones. So, you know, I mean, you could have devices anywhere in the environment, even ones that you are required to carry for work, that could be communicating silently and invisibly, you know, this information on your chip, giving away your exact location. Yes, as you say, these devices can be anywhere, pretty much. And even though this is a short read range, it's very invasive, and in fact, maybe more invasive, because think about it. If you are in range with a reader device within, I think it's 10 centimeters, these new chips are communicating, which is a short distance. But that guarantees that's you right there, and there aren't going to be any other chips in the vicinity. So don't be fooled by the fact that a lot of these companies are going to say, don't worry about it, it's just a short read range.
Well, Liz, what is the rationale for companies wanting to implant chips in employees? Is it to make sure they're on the job, so sort of attendance monitoring?
There could be all sorts of ulterior motives, but at this point, at least this Wisconsin company is claiming it offers a way to pay. A way to go to a cashless society, and they are hoping, this company, that they're setting a precedent by having their employees tagged to communicate to the rest of us, hey, this is no big deal, implant a chip, and then you can come to our snack kiosks, which is what this company does. They sell snacks in places, I guess, like airports and colleges and I believe even prisons. And so have this chip implanted, you know, and then it's so easy for you to walk up and just get a snack. You don't even have to pull out your wallet. So that's kind of the motivation in this case. And in other cases, it's supposedly for security, although in the past, chips like this have been hacked and even cloned, which puts the security into question.
Well, we want to talk about the privacy concerns in a minute. I wanted to just go back to the employee scenario. How do companies, I think you've partially answered this, market to their employees. Convenience, just, you know, swipe your wrist or whatever, and it's deducted from your credit card. What if a staff member does not want to do this? Are they able to opt out of it?
Now, this is a very interesting point, Heidi. I'm glad you brought this up. Well, first of all, I just want to clarify that this Wisconsin company called Three Square Marketing, the snack kiosk vendor, is not the first company, even though they claim to be the first company, to chip their employees. Another company in Cincinnati, Ohio, called City Watcher, did that back in 2006, supposedly for security reasons, and that company is no longer in business, and it was really clear there was this really bad information given to employees about what the implications were of the chip. I mean, they were told, oh, if you don't want it anymore, no big deal. Just like, you know, they didn't even think about, what if I don't work there anymore? And the same thing seems to be happening in Wisconsin, and they're selling this to their employees as saying it's completely voluntary, that you can just remove it just like a splinter, no big deal. You know, and of course it's voluntary, but how voluntary, Heidi, is it when the boss asks you to do something like, I don't know, like stay late and help work on a project or come in on, you know, on a Saturday to help cheer on the company baseball team?
Right, exactly.
I mean, we all know what it means to say no. And frankly, I think this is the same kind of a scenario, and it's kind of a test case. I frankly, envision lawsuits down the road, and I'm really hoping for this to bring attention to this and this carrot and stick kind of method. Because, you know, if one of these people who decides not to get shipped, and there were some of those at that company, you have to wonder when they're not promoted, they don't get a raise, right?
Exactly.
They get the bad job. You know, the lawsuit won't stop there. It's going to be perhaps about suffering health effects, like chip migration. We've seen in pet ships, there's been cancerous tumors growing around pet ships, and these are very similar to the pet ships. And then what happens about when you leave the company? I mean, this is being touted as something that can just be pushed out of your hand like a splinter, but, I mean, once the skin grows around this thing, you're not going to just push this thing out. It's not like getting a pair of tweezers, you know? So I see potential lawsuits. And the way they're selling this in Wisconsin, and this is really important, is strictly voluntary in all this language, which, as we just talked about, is not really voluntary, right?
Right.
I mean, this has been a big push by this company. This is their big PR moment. They're even coming out and claiming that they're the first in the country because they think it's such a big deal, which, of course, we just said they're not.
Right.
This is going to be very, very interesting to watch, but this thing in Wisconsin is especially important because there's a law on the books in Wisconsin against forced human shipping. I don't know if you know that.
No. And how many states, just out of curiosity, even have such legislation?
There are just a few. And in Nevada right now, there's a push by one of the state legislators to have a law similar to the Wisconsin law that prohibits forced human shipping. And I believe they also say it's not just chips but marks, because, you know, at some point down the road these are going to evolve, and we've even seen patents for how this same kind of technology could be imprinted on skin like an electronic tattoo. So it's really important to get ahead of this and look forward to what the potential different ways this could be presented
right
in the future.
Liz, let's talk a bit about some of the privacy concerns. As you mentioned earlier, who wants to give away their Social Security number, especially now that more individuals are aware of how the government and corporations work to really track our every move? Is it just financial information that's on this particular employee chip, to your knowledge?
At this point, that's my understanding for this particular exercise. However, the makers and the purveyors of this chip, a company called Biohax out of Sweden, a company that's shipped lots of people over there. It's like one of the countries that are kind of leading this movement to chip humans. They tout many other applications for this. They want people to use it to unlock their smartphones, to unlock the doors to their homes, to unlock their cars and their computers. And this is extremely dangerous for privacy, and I don't think people have really thought this through, because we want some anonymity when we go online. We don't want marketers knowing who we are when we sign into our computers or our smartphones, right? We already hate the idea that people are tracking, you know, these marketers are tracking us around the internet with these annoying ads. It's kind of like gum that sticks to your shoe and you can't get it off. You know what I mean, Heidi?
Yes.
Imagine now how much more they can know, how much more precisely they can know, you know, who is signing into the internet, who's on the internet. So anything you might want to post anonymously is no longer anonymous. Anything you want to buy anonymously, or even perhaps search for anonymously, could be known. Of course, we recommend, I mean, I work for a company called Startpage.com, which does anonymous searching, and that's certainly going to help private services. But still, you know, when you're on your phone or on your computer, do you really want people knowing who you are? So, yes, it's beyond just the payment information. This unique number could be used for any number of things. Like I say, it's just a number that could link to basically unlimited information and pretty much unlimited applications.
Now, Liz, can you talk a bit about how we hear so much about hacking every day in the news? How could someone hack the chip?
Well, that's a very good question. There are wonderful white hat hackers out there. And by the way, hackers have gotten a really bad name. I believe hackers one day will probably save us, because, you know, we have to get ahead of all this digital spying that's planned and already happening in our world. And it's these white hat hackers who are going to go out and prove that devices like this are inherently unsafe prove the privacy issues and so on. And we've already had somebody call, a gentleman named Jonathan Westhues, back, I believe it was in 2005 or 2006, hacked at that time what was called the VeraChip. Remember the VeraChip?
Yes. So he hacked the VeraChip.
Well, what he did was he was able to prove he could just walk by somebody with a device and pick up the unique number on the chip, clone it, get his own chip, use that same number, and then just walk around and pretend to be that same person.
Stolen identity through chip.
Right, exactly. And who wants that? I mean, imagine the security issues that arise with that kind of a scenario. Not only the security issues that arise with that, but what that means for people who have these chips embedded in them. I know that they can be remotely reprogrammed, which is another privacy concern, which I'm sure hackers will get into as well. So that could be a problem too. But still, I mean, how are you going to really know? It's sort of like, you know, if somebody impersonates you, it's sort of the same or a similar problem to what you have when there's identity theft, right? Where you suddenly open your credit card bill and you find out that someone has, you know, charged $1,000 TV and plane tickets and, you know, a big trip and meals on your credit card. Then imagine the hassle with that, right?
Yes.
Compare that to then having a similar situation, but now you have to dig the chip out or go through the trouble of reprogramming it.
Right.
It's really pretty much a nightmare. It's not like, you know, a credit card where you can just have a new one issued.
Liz, you mentioned VeraChip, and we know, because you and I have spoken about this in the past, it's the company that manufactures microchips and has changed its name over the years and been marketing implantable chips for humans. There was, I believe, a six-month investigation into implantable chips in pets with some of the problems you mentioned. And you were part of determining that the chips were, in fact, causing some cancerous tumors. What's happening with VeraChip? What are they operating still?
That is a very interesting story, Heidi. We just gave them so much bad press, for very good reasons, obviously, that they decided to get out of the microchip business, it seems. They actually changed their name, VeraChip Corporation, to Positive ID. And then they took this human chipping portion of their business, and I believe they call it X-Mark, which is a really bad name. I mean, really, X-Mark. And then this X-Mark entity was then sold off, is my understanding, and purchased by, of all companies, Stanley Black & Decker, the people who make power tools. And it's now, I believe, a subsidiary company located out of Canada. Now, I'm still researching everything because it's really hard to follow the trail, and none of these companies really wants to be associated with this really bad human microchipping idea because people are obviously so upset about it. So it's really hard to follow that trail. So I really haven't seen a lot of activity on that front, at least publicly. I mean, they've kind of gone underground with it. But this other company, Biohacks, is having the chip, it appears, manufactured by another big microchip company. And again, the trail is hard to follow. It's almost like they're afraid to be associated with this chipping for very good reason.
Right. Liz, it reminds me of several big military contractors who changed their name over time, like, you know, Blackwater and others. I guess unfavorable press will do that to you. Liz, I wanted to ask you, since we've talked to you several years ago about your book with Catherine Albrecht, Spy Chips, one of our favorites. Have the actual chips become smaller or more so-called user-friendly over the years?
Of course. Over time, all technology gets more efficient, it gets smaller, it gets actually more stealthy. But it's really interesting now that companies are starting to push it out more. They're not as afraid as they were for a while because, frankly, our book and our activism really gave them a bad name, and they kind of went underground for a while. They're starting to come out again, and I think it's time for us to once again raise a ruckus and really point out what's happening. A lot of companies are starting to bring this into their back rooms, which actually we're fine with that. If they want to track their inventory, that's fine. But still, we draw the line. We say once a product is on a shelf and a consumer can pick it up and walk around with it, with a microchip in it, that should not be the case. I mean, we should be able to buy items that are our own and not be tracked through the things that we wear and carry. That's where we are right now. We're at a point where, you know, things are starting to move forward and we need to start pushing back.
I understand, Liz, that a Seattle-based firm says that it has sold tens of thousands of chips to consumers via its website. It's called Dangerous Things. And that the chip and installation cost about $200. Can I buy a chip and inject it into myself, or do I have to go to a physician to have that done?
Well, it's interesting because I'm very familiar with that website. In fact, the chip they sell appears to be the same chip that Biohax, the Swedish company, is selling to the people in Wisconsin. It's very similar to the chips that get inserted into pets and the ones that Verichip used to hawk, although it doesn't have that coating on the outside that encourages fibrous tissues to grow around it, so it can migrate a little more perhaps. But at any rate, they have been selling these chips to people who want to hack themselves. And Heidi, frankly, I think if people want to hack themselves, they want to put chips in their bodies, they have a right to do it. I mean, that's a right that people should have. I draw the line where people are forced to do this, either by a government or even a company. And of course, as I said, I think that a company saying, oh, it's voluntary, we have to ask how voluntary that really is.
Exactly. And as we've seen, once something becomes normalized to a certain extent, it's not long before we could be looking at the sort of national ID system through RFID chip by the U.S. government.
Right. It could take just a national disaster of some kind to justify this. And in fact, the government is very excited about it. I guess you know we talked before about how former Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson, after he left the government service, he went to Verichip at that time that was marketing these chips as medical devices, as human chipping devices that would convey medical information, a really bad idea that really wouldn't work. But it kind of shows, you know, that kind of thinking. And in fact, Verichip at one point got a contract after the flooding in Louisiana, if you recall. They got a contract to go out and chip dead bodies. The government was trying pretty much any way to try to get this, as you say, normalized. I mean, put them in dead bodies first, and the next step is, wow, it's been in a dead body, why not a live body, you know?
That's interesting. I don't understand the reason for wanting to put them in dead bodies.
Well, it's like tracking any kind of inventory. When you have a lot of dead bodies, their logic was, well, if we inject them with microchips, we'll be able to track who they are by this unique number.
I see.
And then, but a lot of people objected to that. They didn't want that mark in their body, especially there are some people who believe that this is part of an end-time prophecy, that, you know, one day they'll be forced to be marked, and they don't want to be buried with something like that.
Well, I could see a system in the future where, when a child is born, they're automatically chipped.
Unfortunately, I think you're right, and that's why we need to push back against this, and why I think legislation prohibiting forced human implants is such a good idea. A lot of legislators will come back because it's really popular. Most people say, "Yeah, heck yeah, definitely pass that legislation," but they come back saying, "Oh, you know, there aren't really very many microchips around, and who's forcing anyone to get a microchip, right? No one's going to force anyone to get a microchip." And so they say, well, there's no really good reason for this legislation. Well, I say, Heidi, if there's really no big deal right about it, so if there's no big deal and it's not going to hurt commerce in any way, what's the problem in passing legislation prohibiting it?
When you talk about the behavioral modifications, such as the cockpit example, it reminds me, when I go up to the country, all the neighbors have their dogs have those invisible fences and something on the dog's collar so that they start barking ferociously, but they stop 6 inches before the boundary because there's an invisible fence. And that application seems to be much like what you're describing on the airplane scenario, where we get conditioned, if not literally killed, for doing something the government or corporations deem bad.
Right. In fact, you know, it could be at some point where there will be people who will be deemed worthy and unworthy.
Yeah.
Some people who they know have money and who don't have money, right? And there could be discrimination. I mean, it could be that there are some stores that go, hey, you know, I don't want these particular customers breathing my valuable air and pushing my valuable shopping cart. So unless you have the right chip, you ain't coming in here. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And so I could definitely see something like that. I could see people shopping and getting close to a shelf, just like with an external RFID tag of some kind that would be like in a shopper card identifying you and, you know, what your value is to a store. Having this chip embedded, you get close to a shelf and they go, wow, you know, this guy basically eats peanut butter and crackers, not a very good customer to us. He's not going to buy a lot of, you know, high margin items. Well, we'll charge him $5 for this jar of peanut butter, but we'll charge the guy with the Rolex here who always is buying the best champagne and so on, we're going to charge him $3 to incentivize him to return. So I think there are just a lot of issues that could happen because of this chipping, like you say, discrimination, forced fencing of sorts by marketers and by government.
Liz, we only have a few minutes remaining, but one question that I think worth asking is, do you have an opinion about whether or not it may be easier to chip the so-called millennials, the new generation that grew up on computers and is used to hearing the convenience argument?
Well, there are two things here. There's also a lot of talk about how millennials don't care as much about privacy, which I don't think that's true. I think they actually are probably even more in touch with how technology works and how their privacy could be taken from them. And so I think that they could be even more careful and they can discern better when they're willing to give up their information and when they're not. And I think a lot of them will educate themselves before getting chipped. And if they do decide to chip themselves, which personally I think it's a bad idea, but it's their option, I think they'll be very careful about what kind of information and the security around those chips. Like you say, I could see a market for, say, RFID clothing or some kind of jewelry or something to protect against a chip giving out information. Of course, this is harder with the chips like this Wisconsin company is trying to implant in employees because it's between the webbing of the thumb and the index finger. So I don't think many people are going to want to wear gloves in the middle of the summer, you know, and walk around with a glove on their hand, you know, an RFID, you know, Faraday cage of sorts on their hand. But so I think that I would give a lot more credit to millennials than many people are giving them with regard to privacy and chipping. I think they'll be really smart about it. I think they'll be interested in investigating it. And frankly, I think we'll find a lot of white hat hackers out of the millennial population that could well save us one day.
I agree with you on that point, Liz. Now, speaking of action, what can our listeners do if they don't like what they've heard us talking about?
Oh, my goodness. That's a really good question. Well, first of all, this is not just about the microchip. It's about privacy overall. I mean, I think we can agree this is part of an overall push to learn more about people than even their mothers have a right to know, right? Because they want to market and sell things to us, and perhaps governments want to control us and know about us to see if we're a threat to them and so on and so forth. And we see where this could all go. So what I would say is, if you care about this, then you need to start being really concerned about what information you give away, not just through a possible chip, but just overall. I would say don't use biometrics generally to sign into your smartphone and computer, because that is a unique way to identify you. It just plays into this whole narrative, you know, and governments say, well, we need to know exactly who you are and where you are to better market to you and to keep track of who you are and if you're a good person or not, right? You need to, when you're on the internet, to use all kinds of privacy-protecting technology that you can. Be very sensitive to that. Know that, you know, if you go to, say, a company, a search engine like Google, and you type in information, that company is creating a profile on you. They log every time you log in, when you log in, what you look for, what sites you visit, and then those third-party sites are logging information about you. So you're creating an entire profile about yourself, and one day this could be linked to, you know, RFID-type devices. So what I would say is, don't just push it back against the chipping, which is really important. I mean, let's get some legislation. Let's support our legislators and tell our legislators, hey, look, you may think this is not an issue now, and maybe it's not a big problem now, but we want to have legislation against forced chipping because we see this as, you know, a possible end game. But in the meantime, also protect yourself And I would just say, and I work for a company that does anonymous search engine searches, startpage.com. I would say companies like that, you have a lot of free open source software. Companies that aren't siphoning your information, you know, like if you use Windows 10, you know that's a it's like a really bad idea. You're sharing all kinds of information. I say, you know, look to other options, like get a Linux distro, you know? Start taking control of your privacy and what you do with your devices. Don't let, say, Microsoft siphon your information and tell you what you can have on your computer. So Heidi, I think it's not just pushing back against microchips, although that's important, that legislation is important. We need to push back against all kinds of tracking that's happening.
And Liz, if listeners want to follow you, how can they do that?
Well, I am now, reluctantly though, available at Twitter. I mean, I actually use that, but I use it as a billboard, as it should be used. Okay, I don't give out a lot of personal information, but it's Liz McIntyre. You can follow me there. I'd love to have followers. I'd love to, you know, engage in conversation and find people who want to work on this issue. I mean, I've said before, you know, if you guys want to work on it, I'm here. I'm ready to go to work and try to get some legislation done. I'm also often at Reddit in the privacy subreddit there. And there are some discussions frequently about technology like this. I'm happy to engage there with you guys and talk about ways that we can push back.
Oh, Liz, what a wonderful resource you are. You continue to inspire us, and we just love having you on Law and Disorder. So we want to thank you, but also say that we'd like to stay more in touch over the next year.
Absolutely, and I'll stay in touch with you and let you know as I find new information.
Thank you, Liz. Have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Nearly all survivors of human trafficking are affected by post-traumatic stress syndrome and have difficulty assimilating back into society. Most are managing silently to cope with the emotional and physical trauma of their past. The New York-based organization Crossing Point Arts was created to help survivors heal through the arts, including singing, creative art, and poetry. The group provides free art workshops taught by trained teaching artists and supervised by creative arts therapists. Their strategy is based on providing long-term coping mechanisms to better manage PTSD symptoms. Crossing Point Arts has reached nearly 2,000 survivors through art workshops. The workshops are held on the premises of local anti-trafficking agencies as part of a comprehensive program for survivors, which also includes housing, legal, and medical assistance, as well as traditional therapy, educational guidance, and a range of emotional support. Joining us to talk about human trafficking, with an emphasis on New York City, and how survivors can be helped through the arts, is Crossing Point Arts founder and executive director, Anne Pollock. Anne is a musician, visual artist, writer, student of dance, and an activist. Anne Pollock, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
And as a lifelong musician and as a restorer and dealer of vintage flutes, how did you come to be interested in working on behalf of survivors of human trafficking?
I am a true product of my vintage. I was born right towards the end of the civil rights era, the beneficiary of the beginning of integrated education in New Jersey. I was there at the cusp of the women's movement as a girl. We fought, you know, we protested the Vietnam War. I heard my voice in all of that as a child because of me. But even before I could speak, I recognized a deep indignation, moral indignation to the racism in this country. And when I had done years and years and years of reading and exploring this question of what our history was, and then came to learn our current day atrocity, catastrophe regarding, you know, what's known as modern day slavery or human trafficking, I had no choice but to respond. So I used my independent life as in working with musical instruments and sort of a stepping stone and to finance my other passion.
And you've said that the survivors are a population hidden in plain view. As you just did, you use the term modern day enslavement. Can you talk just a bit about both of these phrases? What do you mean hidden in plain view?
Human trafficking is a form of institutionalized slavery, and you know, beneath the radar. And that's the last time we had a name for it in this country. But in my estimation of it, it's never really changed. It's just been like an amoeba, changed shape and changed appearance. So, you know, those who care about WBAI and on the air, we talk about the prison industrial complex as a form of enslavement. And speaking more specifically to your question, the terms human trafficking and modern day slavery are antiseptic versions of what's going on. And there is a tacit consent, I think, from higher up in this government to this huge moneymaker. And we'll just speak about the U.S. or maybe even just New York in this question, though I'm going to, you know, give big props to the task forces that have increased their intensity and bearing down and making arrests and providing services. It's nowhere in comparison to the numbers of people who are trafficked.
Who's profiting from this?
Well, traffickers themselves are strangely invisible in this whole equation. So how is it they can arrest young women, girls, adult men and women for sex trafficking and labor trafficking, but they can't find their way to the traffickers? So I have my grave suspicions. Wherever money flows, you know, profusely, right, things somehow stay in place. So that's a vague answer to say these are unbelievably, obscenely malevolent people who have figured out a way to, let's say, in the case of sex trafficking, earn $250,000, you know, per girl that they force into sex slavery, turning, you know, 15 tricks a night, and are held there by threats and violence and threats against their family or their kids. And so it's a very tightly woven system that understands the vulnerability of girls and young women and adult women especially. And the majority of human trafficking is sex slavery throughout the world. It represents 80% of all human trafficking is sex slavery.
And in New York City, is this a big problem?
It's a big problem, and it's a growing problem, which is why I believe that I think de Blasio is and his wife Shirlane have done a lot to really push this forward with breaking up the rings. And they have a hotline, which they didn't have before. And, you know, we can't go further in this conversation without acknowledging Rachel Lloyd, the founder of GEMS, which is one of the agencies that we do a tremendous amount of work for in Harlem, who was instrumental in pushing for laws to be changed for a Safe Harbor Act so that, for example, a few years ago, someone who was 16 who couldn't legally have sex, even consensually, could be arrested for being a prostitute instead of being seen as a victim. So,
right, just like prostitutes and the men who hire them, mm-hmm. the women usually get arrested and punished.
Correct. So that remains the case with this whole phenomenon, is that the so-called Johns are not the culprits,
right?
But still,
right.
So they go after the traffic females, mm-hmm. and then they go through the prison system, and then in the best case scenario, they will end up in what's called trafficking court. Uh-huh. And enter the Alternatives to Incarceration program, and that's the long chain of events that leads us to them.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit. The survivors may hear about the arts workshops, mm-hmm. and is it mandatory that they get involved, or is this one option that they have, as I would hope would be a larger therapeutic mm-hmm. package?
That's a great question. We are doing all of our work in anti-trafficking agencies all over the city. And most anti-trafficking agencies are set up as drop-in centers, even though these people are mandated by the court to be there and spend X number of hours with a caseworker. They are nonetheless offered many options there in the drop-in centers, so they can get educational support, tutoring, childcare, housing referrals, medical, legal, and therapeutic. And indeed, our workshops are an option. They're not mandatory. They are strongly encouraged. However, people are there on a very much voluntary basis. And once they catch on, they get pretty hooked generally.
Can you talk just briefly about the post-traumatic stress syndrome symptoms that some of these young women have?
So there's sort of a trajectory. It's very noticeable if someone has walked out of jail within a day or two. There's a glazed overlook in their eye. They stay to the corner. They usually stand up for some reason. They don't sit down. They don't leave the room. They're just there, kind of shut down, trying to figure out. The longer they spend in the midst of their caseworkers and getting the support, and also the community of survivors, they start to figure out, it's okay, I can let my guard down. And generally, what we do see when people walk in the room where the workshops begin is there is a glazed over look, but they're animated to the point where you know they're functioning. And there's in the sort of array of post-traumatic stress things that are noticeable, there's sort of odd physicality. People will be sort of tipped to one side. There's a lot of physical tension. They express a lot of physical pain, which is often very emotionally triggered. There's a distractibility. There's sadness, upset, tears, or just checked out. And the amazing thing about what I've experienced in the microcosm of post-traumatic growth, in the course of an hour, that glazed over look actually leaves their eyes. They start to express a presence and an engagement that is, within 10, 15 minutes of whatever art form, it doesn't matter, it happens. And that is actually one of the things that prompted me to call my organization Crossing Point Arts, because I believe a brain barrier gets crossed and, the whole set of new chemistry goes on to say it's okay to be here.
Right. Are the survivors primarily women?
We've worked with 100% women. We're really striving to connect with agencies that deal with male survivors and LGBTQ youth, homeless, often,
right.
Which would be a more male and trans population. So we're headed in that direction.
And are they young? That's what I assume, but can they be of all ages?
They can be of all ages. Each agency has a sort of a specialization group. So the GEMS, which stands for Girls Education and Mentoring Service in Central Harlem, is 12 to 22. And a number of the agencies we work with are adult women starting 18, and they'll go as high as mid-late 50s, and those will be the older women more likely to have been labor trafficked, you know, anywhere in between, and, you know, domestic and international populations.
And the classes or workshops, is it art, making art or dance? What gamut is it?
So when I designed this whole initiative, I first recognized that there were no dedicated workshops taught by teaching artists that really dug in deep. And I thought about, you know, what has culture always done for the enslaved and the oppressed? It's provided everything we call the arts: music, dance, storytelling, visual arts, poetry, drama, things, you know. So it was upon me to find teaching artists in every discipline and also just weave it together as an offering of culture to people who are so starved for it, actually.
Do some of the girls make friendships in these workshops?
Yes, it's a really lovely element. We sometimes sort of encourage it, but in general, they find each other, they find kindred spirits, and there's such a strong feeling of community in the workshops that they are, in fact, very inclined to form other connections outside and then talk about their work they're working on and, you know, show each other their stuff. And so, yes, it is a strong community building energy.
I'm curious, are a lot of these young women homeless, or are they in what kind of living scenario?
They are in a few different scenarios. So speaking of the domestic survivors, they are largely African-American girls who are trafficked. So they will have come from very, very difficult homes, to say the very least, and often will have been survivors of early sexual abuse. So they may be very well figured into the school-to-prison pipeline, and they will have been trafficked often between the ages of, I think the most recent thing I read is between 12 and 14 is the average age that a girl will get trafficked. So she will very often be living in foster care. As they age out of that, then it's homeless shelters. And so the domestic population is more likely to be living in homeless shelters. For the international population, they will be living in what they call family hotels. Are you familiar with
No.
this? So this will be many to a room with maybe a sheet hung in between, and actually some of the trafficking goes on in these rooms, from what I've heard. They're very, a lot in Queens. I'm sure it's going on in the Bronx as well. We work with the Asian population, and this is where I learned about these family hotels.
Who runs these family hotels? The city?
No, some people who are breaking a lot of code laws, I'm sure, because, you know, not enough bathrooms and strange.
And when you say that some of the trafficking may occur there, do you mean that the owners, managers turn a blind eye
that's
to certain activities?
That's what I've heard, and some of the raids will have taken place there as well.
Oh, law enforcement raids,
right? Yeah, so homelessness is in its various forms. There's couch surfing for the younger people, and maybe adults as well. I haven't heard of people living on the street and being trafficked. It somehow doesn't quite fit together. And then in some cases, there are residences, so-called, provided by the traffickers. There was a group of young girls that they were from Ghana, actually, their parents were tricked into believing that they would come here, get an education, go home. And they got here and were forced, they were paid a pittance for hair braiding during the day, and then all lived many, many, many to a room in New Jersey, Newark area, and were forced to do sex trafficking for sex work at night. So, and then crash on their on their mattress for a few hours in between, and at the threat of not only to their own safety, but their families. Well, you know, we will go back to your village and make sure.
Right.
Yeah. So
let's just go back. I understand that, and you have collected flutes over the years.
Yes.
You're an expert in that. You repair them, offer them to children in need, mm-hmm. as well as those recovering from natural disasters. You launched Flutes for Haiti mm-hmm. after the earthquake there.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get this wonderful idea?
Well, let me put it in slightly more accurate perspective. The flutes are donated.
Oh,
so
okay,
I sort of
right.
put it up on my website and let people know, donate your flute, I'll donate the repairs. And sure enough, it's worked. So after the earthquake, I've been very, very closely connected with the Haitian community as a musician and dancer and for years, and I was trying to find something I could do. And I had been to actually a Donna Karen event where she was doing a fundraiser, and she was sort of providing a safety kit for people who were living in refugee camps. So there was a whistle, so you could blow a whistle to avoid sexual assault for women. It was sneakers, it was flashlights, and it was like antiseptic stuff, Band-Aids and bacitracin ointment. And they raised so much money. And I went home that night and I was like, damn it, what can I do?
Mm.
And it came to me. So Flutes for Haiti is the name of it. But a few weeks ago, I was in Cuba and I was able to donate a flute to one of the poorest areas, which is a culturally super rich area outside of Havana called Marianao. Mm. And I brought a flute that someone donated and handed it over with great joy. And
mm-hmm.
So it's a tiny gesture, but it could be life-changing for the person on the other end.
And just in a general sense, what is your comment about funding cutbacks to the arts across the country?
My general and first thought, most every day that I wake up, is there's a lot of money in this country, and the philanthropists know they need to step forward now. The grant-making process is arduous and long and difficult, but that's the window through which we travel. And I believe that the funding cutbacks will eventually morph. I believe that as a country, we believe in the arts enough that philanthropists and people of means will recognize their responsibility and shift gears. I'm horrified along with every other artist, but I also, I remain an optimist. So,
can you give an example or two of a person who has benefited from these art workshops?
I would be glad to. There was this beautiful woman from Cameroon who... She's an adult survivor, and she happens to also have come to our workshops through the Program for Survivors of Torture at Bellevue Hospital. So she had been both trafficked and a torture survivor. She became one of our most devoted workshop participants. She would troop through any weather. She would wait if we were late. One day she waited 2 hours. There was miscommunication. She was committed. And I eventually learned her story is that she was, when we first encountered her, she was quite suicidal because of having lost track of her children in Cameroon, living in uncertain circumstances in every way. And she expressed to us in no uncertain terms that the music was her lifeline and that the only thing that she knew was that if she did it, she would feel better. And so when we asked her what could we do to improve it, she said there should be more people. So we all, there was a research team, there was a bunch of people. I was like, everybody needs to stand up and participate now. You know, the stories are very similar. There was another woman from Bali who long ago had been a court dancer, a professional. I don't know her trafficking story, but after the Afro-Puerto Rican Bomba class, she said, for 10 years, I was like this, and she slumped over at the waist. She said, I was dead inside. She said, this is the first time I'm alive. I know I'm going to be okay now. So it's quite instantaneous because the arts reach into us, all of us, in such a powerful way. And as an artist, as an activist, I knew that I held in my hands a very powerful tool. And I've always seen my role as an artist as something beyond a reflection of my times, or maybe it's my, you know, impulse to reflect in hyper-realism the times I live in, the times we've always lived in, unfortunately. You know, slavery is as old as humankind, or as old since the agrarian age, apparently. So,
and how can listeners learn more about Crossing Point Arts?
So we are at crossingpointarts.org. There's an explanation about everything we do and descriptions of our workshops and even examples from the workshops from survivors. We have an upcoming event, which we do events from time to time, but on October 16th at Greenwich House Music School on Barrow Street, Arturo Oferil will play with his trio as a benefit performance, and I will be speaking about our work, and we'll have examples of survivors' artworks there. Mm. If there are teaching artists in the New York metro area who hear this, be in touch. If you feel like you want to be trained and become part of our cohort of teaching artists, it's a beautiful way of, it's more than giving back, it's entering life in as a very deep level of citizenship, I feel. And for those who really are curious about this, there's a big movement in the anti-trafficking community. It needs help on all sides, but we specifically need all the help we can get to grow this initiative. We're out at the periphery of, you know, we are not food, shelter, and clothing, but I maintain that we are equally important. And we don't let up. I know it's a drop in the bucket, but trying to do my part and trying to encourage other artists to see their role a little bit differently than maybe they had thought of themselves. There's a reason that you don't know. You know, I could point at the media, but I kind of see it from higher up.
Well, I guess it's been institutionalized in a way that I had never really contemplated.
Yes. And people find it to be an overwhelming topic, and therefore they shut it out and shut it down and don't feel that they have a responsibility beyond making sure that their immediate families and friends are okay. People are, I'm going out on a limb saying this on WBAI, which is, you know, I've grown up with this organization, with this radio station, and learned how to be a human from BAI in many ways. I know we're activists all together, but this population is monumentally overlooked, in my opinion. And I think it's in the context of this country, we have not, in the words of Bryan Stevenson, we have not properly atoned for our history of enslaving people, and therefore there is no proper context to speak about this unspeakable problem.
And Pollock, it's been wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for your important work.
Thank you so much for having me on the air and for, you know, giving us an opportunity to express something of great importance.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.